Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Well, today it's the best and the worst of fast food from the Center for Science in the Public Interest. We have a real-world take on what to eat on the road from their senior nutritionist, Jane Hurley. She's the co-author of the center's new book, Restaurant Confidential. Beer authority Stephen Beaumont shares his favorite summer afternoon beers. Now, note he's not saying lunch beer or dinner beer. Kitchen designer and cook Deborah Krasner has her picks of great raw food websites, from organic meats and heirloom seeds to chestnut flour. Reporter Scott Haas checks in from a bar in Rio de Janeiro. Then a sensory scientist has the latest research on how our pets experience flavors. At last, the real reason why Tabby's so finicky. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's get rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. So, Jane, Michael, have you been traveling again?
We've been in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where we discovered some wonderful sliders.
Sliders.
Sliders to the hamburger aficionado are teeny weeny greasy little hamburgers, kind of the prototype for the White Castle kind of hamburger.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
This is a restaurant called the Hamburger Inn. It's been in Sioux Falls, South Dakota since 1931. It's a diminutive 12-stool diner where you sit at the counter and watch Nels Nelson, the proprietor, cook these teeny-weeny hamburgers and put them on teeny-weeny buns. Now, one of these burgers is hardly enough to even scratch the itch of appetite. So what many people do, and what I highly recommend, is to get a double or perhaps a triple cheeseburger, which is three patties of beef inside one bun. That's just about right.
Actually, we were sitting next to a UPS driver who was having, breakfast or lunch, brunch of sliders, and he ordered a triple, so it was really nine hamburgers on three buns
with cheese, of course.
And it didn't seem to faze anyone. There were no sort of, you know, blinking eyes or lifted eyebrows when he ordered a triple.
So the concept of slider is there is so much delicious grease it just goes right down.
Yeah, it's really delicious. It's wonderful to watch the guy make it because, I mean, the griddle is kind of tilted in such a way that the grease kind of stays there. And what he does is to slap for each burger, he slaps a sphere of meat onto the griddle about the size of a golf ball and then takes his spatula and, against all rules of hamburger cookery, squishes it down on the griddle. And of course, in doing so, it absorbs plenty of fat and the bun is spongy enough to absorb that fat. And it's really, really delicious. Although I dare say not for the fat phobe.
It's certainly the opposite of the George Foreman grill, you know, where the fat, what they
all
sell
the grease that drips off the George Foreman grill goes to the Hamburger Inn.
Goes to the Hamburger Inn, and they put it back in the hamburger.
Do they do anything else?
Very little. I mean, you can get a bag of potato chips, and I think actually, in fact, they do maybe make some other sandwiches, but nobody at the counter eats anything but hamburgers. And frankly, at the Hamburger Inn, that's what you should have.
Nels Nelson's wife is part of the operation, and it's such a wonderful little mom-and-pop place that every 15 minutes or 10 minutes, she will come out with an old-fashioned Melmac dinner plate onto which are a dozen little raw hamburger balls, and she will give them to Nels, her husband, who then puts them on the grill, squishes them, and makes the sliders. And what Bev does is just walk back and forth from the little kitchen in the back to where Nels's griddle is.
And she also offers a certain commentary on the conversation at the counter, and I don't remember what it was, but I remember she was very disapproving of what the counter conversation was when we were there the last time.
Yeah, there's no, you know, this is a no profanity, no obnoxious comment kind of a place. It's very, very straight and on the up and up.
And cozy enough that no matter what your conversation is at the counter, everybody else will hear it. This is not the place to go for a private or, for that matter, romantic dinner.
Is there anything else in Sioux Falls?
Isn't Minerva's in that?
Yeah, there's actually a deluxe restaurant in Sioux Falls called Minerva's, and it's the swanky place in town. And pretty darn good. I mean, it's frankly, I prefer the cheesy, cheap sliders. If you want a nice meal in Sioux Falls, you can go to Minerva's and get a nice meal, like actually, you know, pretty modern food.
And there are statues of the goddess Minerva with her owl on her shoulder, since she's the goddess of female wisdom, all over the restaurant.
This is reassuring. So we go to Minerva's for fancy food, and then the next day we eat sliders. Hey, thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander to the world with me. And any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the road.
Gene and Michael Stern's newest book is the update of their great classic Road Food. Now, you can hear them here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to our website, splendidtable.org. Expert Stephen Beaumont is constantly hunting down exceptional beers. One thing I like about Stephen is he always has a specific food in mind to pair with the beer. Now, he reports on the beers in his books, on his website, and here on the Splendid Table. Steve, good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn.
Steve, is there something you particularly like to drink during the summer?
Well, you know, when I think of summer, I think of wheat beers. And when I think of wheat beers and I think of maybe a wheat beer for the afternoon, I think of the Belgian style of wheat beer, often known as witbier, bière blanche, tarwebier, or simply white beers.
Now, I love this, that you have an afternoon beer as opposed to an evening beer. What do these beers taste like?
Well, what makes them beautiful afternoon beers is that they're light, effervescent, and truly refreshing beers. These are made with barley malt, as most beers are, but also some unmalted wheat. And what unmalted wheat gives the beer, a couple of things. One is a lightness, just a real light flavor. Another thing is a slight citrusy character, which tends to come from using wheat in a beer. And also a haziness, because what wheat contributes to these beers is a protein. And the proteins can tend to get a little hazy when the beer is cooled down. So you get what's called in brewing a protein haze. And the light hits that, and the beer just sparkles. It's a very summery image. They're also flavored with coriander and orange peel.
Oh.
So they have wonderful, wonderful tastes like that, a nice spiciness from the coriander and a little fruitiness.
Are there certain foods that you would have with these beers?
Absolutely. These are brunch beers. These are terrific with any egg dish you want to throw at them. Scrambled eggs, omelets, poached eggs. Wonderful beers for having with a brunch. Or just a simple light sandwich, you know, a chicken salad sandwich and a wheat beer, or a mild cheese sandwich and a wheat beer. Just terrific combination.
Are there certain brands to look for?
Well, the original revivalist wheat beer is called Hoegaarden. And I'm going to spell that out because it's a little funny. It's spelled H-O-E-G-A-A-R-D-E-N. And, of course, this is a Flemish word. It comes from the north of Belgium. It's now owned by the brewing giant Interbrew, a Belgian company. And it's a terrific beer. It tends a little more towards the fruity side of things. You get a little softer, orangey flavor. But it's still a very, very nice beer. Another one I like actually comes from my neck of the woods, actually close to my hometown. It's called Blanche de Chambly. And it comes from a little town called Chambly outside of Montreal. And the brewery's name is Unibrew. It's a terrific beer that tends a little more towards the coriander side, and so it's a little spicier than the Hoegaarden. And then there are several others. Of course, almost every second Belgian brewery makes a white beer, so you see a lot of different Belgian whites around, and a lot of small breweries in the U.S., like Victory Brewing down in Pennsylvania, they make a Whirlwind wit beer. Over in Colorado at Fort Collins, the New Belgium Brewing Company makes their Sunshine Wheat, which is a very soft and really nicely drinkable wheat beer.
Oh, this sounds great. Hey, Steve, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Stephen Beaumont is author of The Premium Beer Drinker's Guide, the world's strongest, boldest, and most unusual beers. You can find his white beer picks on our website, splendidtable.org. You know, right now, if we could walk into a Belgian pub together, I'd sit you down to my favorite summer lunch, a cold white beer and a tartine au fromage. Now, this is an open-faced sandwich. It's kind of a slab of coarse country bread spread with fresh cheese. It's called fromage frais. It's low in fat, and it tastes clean and tangy, and it's just perfect for this time of year. Now, you can get this sort of cheese in most cheese shops. I've just found one from Michigan that's a gem. It's called Sharon Hollow Chive Garlic Cheese, and you can find it at the Splendid Table store. So for the recipe and everything else, just go to splendidtable.org. Coming up, the best and the worst in fast foods, stellar food sites on the web, and our open lines for calls. The number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. A lot of us hate to admit it, but the occasional fast food meal does pass our lips. Let's face it, sometimes there's no other choice, especially if you're on the road, and especially if it's with kids. Well, accepting that as a given, where do you go for the healthiest fast food? Now, maybe that's an oxymoron, but to find out, we have with us the senior nutritionist of the Center for Science in the Public Interest. She is Jane Hurley, and she is co-author of that organization's newest book, Restaurant Confidential. Jane Hurley, welcome.
Thank you.
Jane, could you explain how you work? I mean, how do you determine your findings?
We actually spent 10 years researching the foods that we included in this book. For table service restaurants, we had foods purchased all over the country and had them flown to an independent laboratory to have them analyzed. For the fast food chains, we used the information provided by the companies, took a look at it, and included that in the book as well.
Is that information reliable?
It is. In fact, we did some spot checking on company information, analyzed a few items from each of the national chains, and what we found was that pretty much the numbers were right on target.
Okay. Well, that's what I'd like to focus on is fast food. Almost all of us eat fast food. So tell me, the two maybe main losers on your list of fast food places?
Well, I think right off the bat, I should mention French fries. Everyone thinks of French fries as a side dish, but they shouldn't. For example, if you order a McDonald's Big Mac and an order of supersized fries, you're getting just as many calories and as much saturated fat in your French fries as you are in your Big Mac. So you really need to think of French fries as having a burger with your burger.
That is such bad news. What about chains? Which are the ones you feel maybe we should avoid?
Well, I think that no matter where you go, there's something to eat. That's the good news. But some chains are doing it worse than others. For example, Burger King's French fries are the worst that you can find at a major fast food chain. They also have claimed to having the worst milkshake. Their new old-fashioned milkshake that they just recently introduced is one of the worst you can get. Just a medium size, which is not a large at all, has basically 700 calories and more than an entire day's worth of saturated fat. McDonald's may be a little easier on your heart, but not your waistline. A large shake at McDonald's can run you 1,000 calories.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. What about something like, I'm thinking ethnic foods, like something like Taco Bell? How is Taco Bell in terms of being healthy?
Well, Taco Bell has some reasonable choices also, like the gorditas and the soft tacos and the fiesta burritos. But one reason they fare so well is because the portions of these foods are fairly small. So the calories and the saturated fat don't climb too high just because of the size of the item itself.
Now, do you have two chains or two fast food vendors that you really like, perhaps?
Well, actually, I'm going to have to expand that to three places. I think you can get some very unique foods, and you might want to even go out of your way to try them. McDonald's has the fruit and yogurt parfait, which is one of the best places to get fruit at a fast food restaurant. They layer strawberries and blueberries with a delicious, creamy, almost custardy-like, low-fat yogurt, and then they top it with a high-fiber granola. Now, Burger King just recently introduced the Veggie Whopper, and it's the first burger chain to offer a veggie burger nationally. So that's a place to head if you want to steer clear of the meat altogether. And then Wendy's, I think, deserves credit for their Garden Sensation salads. They've really taken iceberg lettuce to a whole new level. Instead of just the shreds of iceberg lettuce with a little bit of cheese grated on top, they use dark leafy greens, super sweet grape tomatoes, mandarin orange sections, slivered almonds. I mean, these are salads that are enticing, that make you want to order them.
Okay, let's go to the mall. Tell me about mall food, because that's a real challenge.
Mall food is a challenge because a lot of people walk into a mall picking up a snack and maybe walking away with an entire meal's worth of calories. For example, you might go to Starbucks and pick up a venti white chocolate mocha. Well, just one of those drinks has 600 calories and 3/4 of a day's saturated fat. The good news is you can fix almost any coffee drink by just getting it made with skim milk and skipping the whipped topping.
Okay, all right, that's good news. I can still have the coffee.
You can. And if you're thinking about some of those big warm pretzels that you can find in the mall, again, you're looking at about 500 calories in that pretzel. So not one of the worst things you can get at the mall, but certainly not diet food either. My advice with the soft pretzels is to skip the butter and get a plain variety. That way you can knock the calories down to about 350.
Okay. Do you have any strategies? Because we're all going to be on the road this summer and, you know, doing takeout and that kind of thing from all of these places. What can we do? What should we be thinking about?
Well, I think the simplest thing is to get a grilled chicken sandwich if you aren't sure. Most places offer them, and most of them are very reasonable choices. Just be careful that they're not really loading them up with full-fat mayonnaise. While mayonnaise won't clog your arteries, it does add a lot of calories, 100 to 150 calories to a sandwich. So you could either skip the mayonnaise entirely or ask for light mayonnaise. Some McDonald's and Burger King's do offer light mayonnaise. Another thing you could do is head to the salads. Again, skip the full-fat dressing. It's not going to be low in calories. Many places offer a light or even a fat-free dressing to go on top of your salad.
Okay. Well, you know, what about Subway? They advertise that you can lose weight eating their sandwiches.
Subway is a terrific place to go if you don't want to think about what you have to order. For example, they have an entire line of subs, 7 subs, in fact, with less than 6 grams of fat. You could order any of those off the menu and walk away with a reasonable amount of calories. And if you're a tuna salad sandwich fan, Subway's another place to go. A typical deli tuna salad sandwich with mayo on the bread runs 800 calories at a sandwich shop. But at Subway, they're making their tuna salad with light mayonnaise, which cuts the calories in half. So if you really are a tuna salad sandwich fan, Subway's the best large chain to go to for that.
Well, Jane, thank you.
Thank you.
Jane Hurley is senior nutritionist at the Center for Science and the Public Interest. She's co-author of the book Restaurant Confidential. Deborah Krasner is a food writer and kitchen designer. She's one of those people who's always looking at new ways of doing things. Deborah, good to have you back.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, so you've been up on the web, right?
I have, and I started actually thinking about raw foods, which is one of the latest trends in the food world. And I started searching on raw food sites, and I found some incredible, incredible things that you can get on the web that who knew you could get. For instance, there's a site called pinenut.com where you can buy wild pine nuts in the shell.
Huh.
Just unprocessed, wild, raw pine nuts. That seems to me to be an incredible thing that you can have delivered to your door.
You know, I don't think I've had a pine nut in the shell for 30 years. They're really dynamite.
Yeah, I'm excited. I also found a wonderful olive oil from Portugal that's organic, and it's only imported by one man, and it's available only on the web. His site is called olivetreeworld.com, and the olive oil is called Romo, and I've tasted it. It's just wonderful.
Huh.
And I've been thinking a lot about, you know, what if you're concerned about the meat that you feed your family and you want to find meat that's organic and that's raised as close to nature as possible? It turns out that there are lots of sources for such things on the web, and the prices are pretty reasonable. I found a number of interesting meat websites. One of the most famous is called Neiman Ranch. You probably know them. It's mm-hmm. NeimanRanch.com, and they sell beef, pork, and lamb. Another is a ranch called Maverick, MaverickRanch.com, which sells certified organic beef. And then there's something called govbiz.com/porkpage, which has organic pork.
This is from the government?
Apparently. Or at least they subsidize the webpage.
Uh-huh.
And then finally, there's a farm in Pennsylvania called Getty Farm, which sells not organic, but livestock that's raised without antibiotics, and they sell beef, pork, Thanksgiving turkeys, and chickens. So you can special order your Thanksgiving turkey and have it delivered to your door.
This is great. This is
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, we live in a world where really it doesn't matter where you live in the United States. You can get any ingredient you want by searching the internet.
Huh. Any other sources that have really, for you, been exciting, been fun?
Well, I like to garden, and I'm interested in heirloom seeds, and of course there are a number of wonderful American sites, but what I found really intriguing was a French site which has pages in English, and it's called terredesemence.com. It'll be on the website for anybody who doesn't understand my French, and it sells hard-to-find European heirloom seed. I think that's just so exciting.
Deb, the other part of this whole thing with the web is that there's so many ethnic food sites, you know, for groceries and that kind of stuff. What are some of the things you're using now?
Well, I like to cook different kinds of food different nights of the week. So for me, it's just wonderful. One of my favorite sites is one called globalfoodmarket.com. And it's a grocery store, and everything in it is at grocery store prices. But they have this enormous range of ethnic ingredients. They cover the Eastern Mediterranean, France, India, Spain, South America and the Caribbean, the Orient, Italy, and Africa.
Huh.
What more could you ask for?
Not much.
Then I also like specialized sites. There's a wonderful Spanish site called tienda.com, which has everything you would ever want to get from Spain, including those wonderful clay pots to cook in, cazuelas. Then you can actually order from Italy, from that famous food store, Peck, and get the best of Milanese food delivered to your door. The website is called peck.it, IT for Italy. And another Italian website that I love is from Arthur Avenue in the Bronx in New York, and it's Titel Brothers. The website is titelbros.com. Mm-hmm. And I found them because I was searching for chestnut flour, because I wanted to make an Italian chocolate cake with chestnut flour. And it was extraordinarily hard to find it until I got to Titel Brothers. And I called them up and they said, of course we've got it. How much do you want?
Deb, this could really be dangerous. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Deborah Krasner is a food writer and kitchen designer based in Vermont. She's the author of Kitchens for Cooks. Now you can get her web finds on our website, splendidtable.org. Reporter Scott Haas goes to the source. When he wanted to find out what made Swiss milk so special, he trekked into a cow pasture in Switzerland. When he wanted to find out what makes Iron Chef Morimoto tick, he went into the kitchen with him and almost had his microphone cord severed when he got it too close to the chopping board. Well, the last time we heard from Scott, he was heading south.
I'm in a bar in Rio de Janeiro in search of new flavors, in search of new tastes. I'm tired of all the cocktails that you have all the time, so I'm here to discover some of the typical cocktails of Rio de Janeiro. I'm here with Maria. You're going to help me interpret because my Portuguese is not what it used to be.
Don't worry.
Okay, so thank you very much. And there's a bartender, Marcos. What are some of the typical drinks of Rio de Janeiro? What can I look forward to? What are some of the ingredients in these drinks?
I think I should start with caipirinha, which is the most famous Brazilian drink. It's a national drink. You can make it with lime and Brazilian rum. And it can be mixed with passion fruit. And then you have variation with Brazilian fruits, with Indian's name. I can translate in English, like jabuticaba.
In front of me are the beautiful, these are the limes?
Yes, and you can see they are different than the ones you see in the U.S. The skin is different, the color.
So I'm just going to take a couple of these. These are kind of a harder skin. It almost looks like tangerines, but these are limes?
This is a tangerine.
Okay.
Yes, which you can make a tangerine caipirinha as well.
Okay, and these are the limes?
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
Now, so in other words, you can make the, how do you say it?
Caipirinha.
Caipirinha.
You can make it with lime, with tangerine, with passion fruit,
and
with
this
grapes.
This over here is a...
It's passion fruit.
It's a jug. I'm going to lift open the top to smell it. Well, that's great. That's beautiful.
Exactly. Strong.
Very strong, but very delicious smelling. And why don't we ask the bartender to show us how to make one of the drinks? It's a caipirinha.
Caipirinha.
Caipirinha. It'll get better with time. My Portuguese is improving by the hour.
You're doing well.
Very kind of you. So the bartender, Marcos, is it?
Marcos.
Marcos, could you make one of these drinks for us, please?
Fazer uma caipirinha.
All right, so explain to me what he's doing. The first thing, what's he going to do the first thing?
Okay, vamos começar, Marcos. Sucar de lime.
So he's sliced off all the sides, and he's taken out the pulp. He's putting the entire lime inside a glass.
Yes.
And now he's sliced up a second lime. I'm used to a drink where you take a lime and like a margarita, say, you'd squeeze the lime in it, but he's actually putting in two entire limes.
That's what makes the difference.
Okay.
It's how he's going to make it. And now you add 2 spoons of sugar.
And now he's crushing it. So he's crushing the lime with the sugar, so it's becoming almost a soupy texture. I mean, I think about what you might do with mint juleps, that's similar to this. He's also cracked about a handful of ice. Oh, this looks great. But it's different than a mint julep because he's made it into a pulp. And now he's adding the rum. Does it matter what kind of rum he adds?
It has to be Brazilian rum.
Well, of course it has to be Brazilian rum. What kind of...
Cachaça.
We're standing in a bar with there's hundreds of bottles of rum. What's cachaça, a type of rum?
No, cachaça is all the rum, and then you have the different types.
Okay.
All the rums you call cachaça.
So he added a white rum.
Yes, white cachaça.
Okay. He's going to stir it. And I'm going to taste this, okay. All it is two limes that have been sliced and crushed with a couple of tablespoons of sugar, some rum, some ice, and I'm going to give it a whirl and see. I mean, it's tough work, but somebody's got to do it. well, that's delicious, but, you know, if I didn't see you do it, I would think there's no rum in this at all. Is that really rum, or is that just water?
Believe me, that's
well, ask him, ask him, ask him. Can I smell that? Wait a second.
He's going to show you the bottle so you'll believe him.
Well, it smells like rum, but this is very dangerous because you don't taste the rum at all. This is delicious, this drink of this caipirinha. What are some of the other fruits that you would add to make different types of them?
Marcos, que outros frutos você utiliza para fazer a cachaça? Sem ser a...
Abacaxi, maracujá.
You can use pineapple, passion fruit, grapes.
Uva.
Tangerine.
Anything you like.
Any fruit. Strawberries.
Cereja.
Cherries.
Is this a new drink? I've never heard of it before. Has it been around in Brazil for hundreds of years? Or
the traditional one, yes. And
really?
Now they start making this this new strawberries and cherries. It's a new variation.
Well, it really is an unusual taste because you taste a blend of the rum and of the lime, and it's very surprising, and it's delicious. So with all this sugar in these drinks, isn't that a highway to a hangover?
He said yes.
Okay, so when you drink rum, I suppose you drink a small amount.
Pode pedir sem açúcar também, se cliente.
A good way to do it, drink it without sugar if you don't want to have a hangover.
Right. Or maybe just have one. Well, thank you very much for explaining this to me. I've learned a lot.
Obrigado.
Reporter Scott Haas is based in Boston. Speaking of Brazil, our friends at the Alexis Bailey Vineyard here in Minnesota had a party recently, and they served a wine drink that they'd come across in a newspaper. It was created to celebrate Brazil winning the World Cup, so we dubbed it the World Cup Cup. Now, it's delicious, and this is how you make it. You take a carafe, and in the bottom of it, you mix together fresh lime juice and sugar, and then you pour in an iced bottle of red wine. And you put ice in wine glasses and just pour the stuff over it. It is dynamite, especially in hot weather. So the recipe's up on the website. And again, that website is splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. What in its youth is both male and female, has never mated in captivity, and can live in fresh water, salt water, and on land? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment, and you can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question was a real puzzler. Here it is. What in its youth is both male and female, has never mated in captivity, and can live in fresh water, salt water, and on land? Well, we're talking about the eel.
And, you know, the eel is pretty mysterious. Scientists think that all eels in Europe and America are born in the Sargasso Sea. Now, this is way out in the Atlantic, kind of east of Florida. But nobody has ever seen an eel mate or give birth. After they're born in salt water, the young eel grows up in fresh water. And while they're young, they're all hermaphrodites, meaning that they're both male and female. By the way, this did not come from my own brain. I got all of this information out of a new book called Consider the Eel. Now, the eel is sort of the wunderkind of the water world. Do you know that an eel can live up to 36 hours on land, and they have been known to travel miles overland to get to a pond or a stream? Now, the first food that a young eel tastes is going to become its food of choice for life. So, feed a newly arrived eel mosquitoes and it can throw away the bug spray. And what do eels taste like? Well, they're juicy and they're real moist and meaty and they taste like chicken. We're opening the lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We've got Jeff on the line. So, Jeff, what's on your mind?
Hi. Listen, I just got a Cuisinart ice cream maker.
Oh, you lucky thing.
Yes, and I've been kind of experimenting with different sorbets. I live in California, so people like kind of the fat-free stuff.
Yeah.
So, and rather than just a regular sorbet, I've been experimenting with fruits and herbs together, and I've come up with, like, raspberry basil.
Well, that
sorbet.
Sounds good.
Yeah, and then also another one is mango jalapeno.
Mm.
And my favorite thing is just kind of seeing people's faces when they taste it, because they first taste the berry and or the fruit, and then it finishes off with the herb. And I don't know, it just got me thinking about different kinds of mixtures for sorbets.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you had any suggestions, and also any kinds of, I was also thinking of getting into more of like a savory type of sorbet also, and I was wondering what you could suggest.
Well, let me think. Well, there's one classic that's really great, which is grapefruit with Campari. And Campari has that sort of bitter edge to it. It's dynamite. Okay, you want some unusual combinations. Ooh, I've never done this, but follow me for a minute.
Okay.
What would happen if you took sweet onion, you know, like the Maui onion or the Vidalia?
The Vidalia type, yeah.
Yeah, that type that's really sweet. And you did that with basil, orange zest, and a little chili. That could be, you know, that might, I mean, you'd have to have some sugar in there, obviously.
Okay, wait,
The sweet onion with some basil, a little orange zest, which has that slightly bitter edge, but still very orangey, and a little bit of hot chili.
Huh, like a little chipotle? Or?
Well, chipotle may be too smoky. I'm thinking more like a fresh jalapeno or a dried ancho, which is kind of velvety.
Yeah.
But you could have sparkle if you had a jalapeno or a serrano, or you could have something kind of velvety like a dried ancho, which is kind of mild. And then, you know, tarragon. I remember a long time ago having something in Europe which was, it was served as a palate cleanser and it was sweet. It had a sugar base, but it was not terribly sweet. It was Riesling wine with a lot of tarragon and a little bit of honey.
Oh, that sounds really good.
Doesn't that sound good?
Yeah.
And I mean, it was so much tarragon. I remember this, that there were, you know, a lot of flecking of green.
Mm-hmm.
Another combination that's really great is lemon with rosemary, which is good on so many dishes. It would be really interesting to do it maybe again with a dry white wine base and maybe a little bit of sugar and then fresh rosemary and lemon juice and a little lemon zest.
Wonderful.
I mean, again, I've never tried these, but...
Yeah, I was thinking of trying like a tomato and a tomato and a gin.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah.
That could be really great. You know, the idea of a Bloody Mary sorbet.
Yeah.
You could do a fresh Bloody Mary with all those ingredients and then make a sorbet out of it. That would be pretty cool.
Oh.
I like that idea. And think about, you know what? If you made that sorbet, wouldn't it be neat to drop that into a real simple soup of iced pureed tomatoes that has a tiny bit of cream in it?
That would be...
When the tomatoes are really brilliant and wonderful and fabulous?
Yeah, because the tomatoes on my vine are already starting to ripe.
Oh, I think that would be great. Hey, this great idea. Thank you for turning us on to some great ideas.
Yeah, because it's really fun, and it doesn't take that long.
Yeah, we just dump everything in the machine and let it rip, right?
And the best part, though, is just seeing people's faces.
I like that. I like that. Jeff, thank you.
My pleasure.
Okay.
And, gosh, I love your show.
Thank you. Thank
you.
Great ideas. Okay, let's see who's up next. We've got Caitlin calling. Caitlin, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I'm curious about chocolate-covered strawberries. The other day, my husband and I were walking by a store where we saw some gorgeous chocolate-covered strawberries, huge and just a little bit dappled with condensation. They were beautiful.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
And we walked in and asked how much they were, and they were $3.99 per strawberry.
Oh, my goodness. It makes you want to go out and start growing the strawberries, for goodness sakes.
You can call me frugal, I suppose. I decided not to buy them. And I thought, well, I can make them myself. And I went home and melted some chocolate chips, poured a little condensed milk in. Mm-hmm. I melted them in the double boiler and tried dipping the strawberries in, and it was a complete failure.
Oh, look, we can solve the problem. Don't worry. Very, very quickly. The first thing is start out with really great-tasting strawberries.
Uh-huh.
The thing you want to do is they have to be dry. So you rinse them and then just roll them lightly in paper towel to let any excess moisture, you know, get picked up. And obviously you want fruit that's in very good shape because this is cosmetic as well as flavor.
Mm-hmm.
Then what you should do is use a real premium chocolate.
Okay.
Now the chocolate chips, they're okay for cookies, but I'd recommend you go after either you want a bittersweet. Well, do you prefer bittersweet or do you prefer milk chocolate?
Milk chocolate.
Okay. Even so, a couple of brands to look at, okay? Lindt, which is a Swiss brand, L-I-N-D-T, and it's in a lot of stores.
Okay.
In bars that are about 3.5 ounces. Another one is Valrhona, V-A-L-R-H-O-N-A. And what you want is to get their milk chocolate. It's just going to be a real high quality, good tasting chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
Don't add any condensed milk. Okay?
Okay.
What you want to do is put it in a bowl, put it into a double boiler.
Yeah.
Get just a little bit of steam going. Don't let the bowl touch the water. Just get the water at a gentle simmer.
Okay.
And don't let any moisture get in with the chocolate.
Okay.
And as it melts, give it a light stir. And then I like to put out like a cake rack with, you know, some wax paper or paper towels underneath it, because that's where I'll let the strawberry drain. And all you do is you dab the strawberry into the bowl. And I like to use a deep bowl so that, you know, I can go into the bowl. And you pull it out, let an excess drip off, and put it onto the cake rack, and it'll harden up. Give it a, you know, be patient,
right,
and it'll harden up, and you have got chocolate-covered strawberries.
Yeah, I think the dryness is pretty important, because my problem was the chocolate wouldn't stick.
Yeah, so, and also, you had also diluted the chocolate with condensed milk.
Yeah.
And that doesn't work. You just want pure chocolate.
Just pure chocolate.
Pure...
A friend of mine had told me to put in that condensed milk to make it creamier.
Nah.
No.
You just want pure chocolate.
All right.
Okay?
Sounds good. Would that work for other fruit as well?
Absolutely, as long as the fruit's dry. As long as the fruit's dry, and the fruit should have great taste.
Okay.
Hey, thanks, Caitlin.
Thanks, Lynn.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Call us at 800-537-5252. And let's see, who's been waiting patiently? Oh, Chris is on the phone. Chris, hi.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi. What do you want to talk about?
My new husband and I returned from our honeymoon in Ireland, where we got to try steamed treacle.
Uh-huh.
And
It really reminded him of an old family recipe that's been long lost, and it was really good. And I found some recipes on the internet, but they call for things like caster sugar and treacle, and then it tells you to steam it, and I don't know what any of that means. Help.
Now, when you say steamed treacle, describe what you're talking about.
It was a sponge cake kind of thing that was really, I mean, it was served hot. It was really moist.
Yeah.
Syrupy.
Uh-huh. And it was like a sponge cake that was saturated?
Yeah.
Okay. What you had was steamed treacle pudding.
Okay. That's
what it is. And it's the British and the Irish love steamed puddings. These are usually mixtures that it could be done with sponge cake that's saturated with eggs and milk and treacle. Treacle is kind of like molasses, and there are different kinds of treacle. There's a very dark treacle, there's sort of a golden treacle, and then there's a light one that's also called golden syrup. And it's the closest thing we would have would be something like molasses. Now, if you go up on the internet and you go to ethnicgrocer.com, you probably will find treacle from England that you could mail order. Okay. And when it comes to steaming, I would say generally this is how it works. You need a form, and it looks like a deep bowl. It's often called a pudding bowl in England, and it has a lid on it. It's usually metal. It's like a mold.
All right.
And you follow the recipe, okay? And I know, you know, there's a very well-known British food writer, and she does TV and everything in England. Her name is Delia Smith. And I think if you type in Delia Smith on Google search engine, mm-hmm. you'll find her website because she has recipes like this, and her recipes are great. They work.
Okay.
Yeah, they really do. Now, let me tell you what caster sugar is. Caster sugar, if I remember correctly, is powdered sugar.
Oh.
Okay? So
that's easy.
Yeah, that's easy. And by the way, if you ever see the expression loaf sugar, it essentially means granulated sugar because it used to come in loaves and it used to be snipped and then pounded. But I think caster sugar is powdered sugar. I'm just a little unsure, but I think I'm close enough. Okay. Take Delia Smith's recipe. Get your pudding mold, which you can probably get at a good kitchenware shop, and follow the recipe because it goes into a pot with steaming water, and you cook it, and you serve it hot.
Okay, thank you, Ben.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
I've got a great source for you. If you are lusting for outstanding summer cherries and you don't have any in your area and you feel like spending a fair amount of money, there's an outfit in Seattle that is having a farm pick these incredible tree-ripened cherries, and on the same day they ship it to you. So you get it within a day or two of when it's actually picked. It's called Chef Shop, in one word, chefshop.com. And these are tree-ripened cherries. They've got two kinds that are going to be coming into season very soon. Each one has a brief window, and it's not inexpensive at all. But the cherries are truly not to be believed. So take a look, chefshop.com. Well, the next time you slip a little treat to your pal under the table, think about how your pet experiences those flavors. For instance, why are cats so picky, and why can you basically feed a rock to a dog? Well, dogs and cats live in sensory worlds that are all their own, and those worlds have begun to interest scientists. Dr. Nancy Rawson researches animal chemosensory patterns at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. Dr. Rawson, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell me about your research.
Well, we're interested in the sensory world of animals, in particular cats and dogs. We spend so much time with these animals, and we really know very little about how they experience taste and smell. We tend to assume that they like all the same things we like. But when you think about the natural evolution and ecology of these animals, they really are designed for quite a different type of diet.
Like, what do you mean?
Well, cats and dogs are both carnivores. That means they eat meat. They require meat in their diet. And they've evolved over millions of years to have that type of diet. And cats in particular are what's called obligate carnivores. What that means is that they absolutely require meat in their diet or they will not be able to survive. Dogs, on the other hand, while they do eat meat and they like meat, they can survive on a diet that doesn't have meat in it. And this is something that makes dogs more versatile in their diet. They can eat vegetables or fruit or whatever, and this is reflected in the kinds of compounds that they can taste. The dog's taste system is more similar to the human.
Uh-huh.
So they can taste most of the same kinds of things that we do in terms of sweet, salty, sour, bitter, and the meaty compounds that we would think of as MSG, which are called umami.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the cat?
The cat, on the other hand, is a different creature altogether. The cats we've found actually are not able to detect carbohydrate sweeteners like glucose or sucrose, so table sugar, to a cat is just a textured granular substance.
So that's why when I put the cookie down on the floor for my cat, she just looks at it and puts her nose in the air and walks away?
That's probably why.
I'll be darned.
Although some cats will eat things that we think of as sweet. I've had people tell me, oh, but my cat I'm sure can taste sweet because I'll give her a piece of my sugared donut and she'll love it. Well, guess what she's loving about that donut? It's not the sugar, it's the fat.
Ah.
Cats are very good at selecting fat. They like fat. They know that they need fat in their diet. Cats, in fact, can eat way more fat in their diet than we can and be perfectly healthy.
That's why the top of the whipped cream cake disappeared.
Exactly.
But do cats and dogs taste salt?
Yes, they do. Although, again, dogs will prefer a certain level of salt in their diet. Cats don't seem to be so sensitive to salt because their natural meat-containing diet has sufficient salt in it so that they haven't had to learn to seek out sources of salt. For instance, in cows and deer, vegetarian animals,
mm-hmm.
their natural diet contains very little salt, so they developed mechanisms to be more sensitive to salt so that they can find sources of salt.
Dr. Rawson, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Dr. Nancy Rawson researches how animals experience scents and tastes at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. So until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Mark Twain. He said, "Heaven goes by favor. If it went by merit, you would stay out and your dog would go in." You can find all the information you will ever need on our website at splendidtable.org. Again, the address is splendidtable.org. And while you're visiting, drop us a line at the Splendid Table Forum and take a look at the Splendid Table store. All the proceeds go to support the show. Our show is produced by Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our thanks to Varig Airlines for getting Scott Haas to Rio and for bringing him back. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.